Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. You're about to hear an interview with Norm Bossert. He's the Democratic candidate for North Carolina Senate District 48, encompassing Buncombe, Henderson, and Transylvania counties. The seat was formerly held by Republican Tom Apodaca, who resigned early. His seat was filled by Republican Chuck Edwards, who is Norm Bossert's opponent this November. He has declined our interview request. Norm Bossert, thank you so much for being with us. You're running for Senate District 48. Your opponent is Chuck Edwards. He was recently appointed, and this is the seat that was formerly held by Senator Tom Apodaca. And, you know, I think a lot of our listeners are going to not know who you are at first. So if you could just sort of tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Norm Bossert. I'm a candidate for the 48th Senate seat, as you said. In addition to that, I'm the principal at Black Mountain Elementary School, where I have started my 11th year at that school. Before that, I was the principal of the Progressive Education Program. So I've been a career educator for 44 years, 27 of those years I spent in the classroom. Worked with everything from preschool right on up through young college students on a community college. I have a wife. I have two sons who are grown up. The oldest served time in the military, 12 years, including time in Afghanistan and in Iraq and Japan. And he was in the old guard. He was a tomb guard. And my other son is living in California in Grass Valley, which is an interesting town to visit. You should try it sometime. Yes. Now we live in Brevard and are very happy living there with wonderful people. Very friendly. Every place you go, people have been very supportive. In fact, we went through a tough bout a few years ago where my wife was quite ill. And, well, people came out of the woodwork. There wasn't a church in town that I know of that didn't include her in their prayers. Not even Republicans prayed for her. And we count them as our friends, too. And so we benefited from the warmth of a small town. Mm-hmm. And we've been there for about 21 years now.
So you feel very at home there.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so this is not your first foray into politics. I have from your bio that you are the Transylvania County Democratic Party chair. Is that current or was that?
That is not current.
Okay.
I did that for three years mm-hmm. Until I announced my candidacy for the 113th seat in the State House of Representatives.
Right. And so that was the last election cycle. And you lost to Chris Whitmire. It was a kind of a landslide election, but that must have been a very conservative district. Now, this district. Yeah. And so this is a different district that you're running in. So I was looking at the numbers. Senator Apodaca won his last Senate seat by about 15 percentage points. So it would appear to lean Republican. Can you tell me a little bit about the district and how you kind of hope to overcome that?
Well, we have a different circumstance now than we did a few years ago. Senator Apodaca is no longer in office. And although Mr. Edwards has just been appointed senator, he still has to earn that seat back in November if he wants it. I think it does sort of give him a little bit of an edge in the election. But we have different times now. We've had two more years of abuse of our public schools and the neglect of our public schools. We've had two more years of interesting tax policies that have not been kind to working people. We've had two more years of the state government under the aegis of Tom Apodaca and his friends reaching into local government and taking decision-making opportunities away from them, as in Charlotte and with the water up here in Asheville and, of course, the airport down in Charlotte. So the Dillon Rule, which has to do, of course, with the state's setup so that our central government is more powerful than our local governments, I think it's really hurt local communities quite a bit. I think that when local county commissions and local school boards make decisions for their communities, that those decisions ought to be respected if they're constitutional and, you know, if those ordinances are in accordance with the law. And I don't think the state should reach in and try to overturn that. The electors, the people who vote, have a chance to say they don't approve of this law, that the next time an election comes up. That should be left in the hands of local people. So I think things have changed. The government has reached into our pockets. They've reached into our lives and local decision making. I mean, probably the best example I can think of really is the Asheville example, where the struggle is still going on over whether the state has a right to determine who owns the water and who gets to decide where it goes. What sane community organization, what county commission is going to invest in infrastructure and ask their taxpayers to invest in infrastructure if the state can come and take it away from you? It doesn't make sense. And the decision is bizarre. Usually, I think of Republicans as small government people. In North Carolina, they are big government people. And this little Democrat over here running in this very conservative district, I am by far more conservative when one talks about home rule. I think our counties need to determine their future more than they do now.
Well, you probably just answered my question. I was going to ask you about the Asheville Districts Bill, because that was one of the last acts of Senator Tom Apodaca. And it failed right at the end there with a lot of Republican opposition, actually, in the House. So this is a district that represents part of South Asheville. So Senator Apodaca did represent that area, and he did want to give the residents of South Asheville a voice on the city council. They haven't been represented on city council in a long time, but it was opposed by the entire city council. It was opposed by the entire delegation of Buncombe County, other than Tom Apodaca. How would you have handled that differently, or would it even have been an issue?
It wouldn't have been an issue in my case. I believe that should be a local decision. If the citizens of Buncombe County and Asheville want to change how they're districted and how they vote for their officials, I think that's their business. And they have the opportunity to do something about it. If the majority of people are opposed to that, then it shouldn't happen. And it shouldn't be our state legislature that reaches into their lives and says, we're going to make you break up into these districts that are artificial and that may not really meet the needs or the desires of the people in the communities. If sometime in the future that's a decision local people make, then I say, well, that's their decision to make. Mm-hmm. I'm a real believer in local rule where it's appropriate. I mean, there are some places where you can't, where the state has to make decisions, not so much for individual communities as regions of our state. I mean, Western North Carolina is a region of North Carolina, and sometimes the state needs to make decisions in Raleigh that are too big for Asheville to make. Asheville can't make decisions for Bryson City. Mm-hmm. That's not reasonable. But what is reasonable is for the state to say, well, we need to make a decision about the forests and the wilderness here in North Carolina, and we're going to put our weight behind this. And when we do, it's to benefit or to not benefit either business or to benefit the people of Western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. That's a decision I think that's appropriate for Raleigh to make, but not to come into Asheville and tell the Ashevillians how they're going to live their lives.
You know, local control also plays into House Bill 2, and I want to ask you about House Bill 2, because that, I think, that may be the defining issue in state elections in North Carolina now, with the decision by the ACC to pull championships, the NCAA earlier this week, mm-hmm. the NBA, of course, Bruce Springsteen started sort of the dominoes falling of all these performers exiting the state. What do you think about House Bill 2? If elected, how would you handle that situation differently?
Well, first of all, let me say I would want it repealed. That's number one, right off the bat. But I think of it as a school principal. I spend my days with 9 and 10-year-olds. And some of the issues have everything to do with the way we treat each other as human beings. In schools, we have children, and those children sometimes say and do unkind things to each other, or they bully one another occasionally and have to deal with that. And sometimes the victims of this bullying are children who are different from other kids in one way or another. Sometimes they're just at a point in their life where they're struggling with their own sexuality or confused about things like that. And to me, I want to protect those children from decisions made at the state level that could further victimize kids. Our government should be the place where we go to protect people and their rights, to guarantee equal protection under the law. And HB 2 really violates the equal protection under the law idea, the whole concept of it. So I'm opposed to it on that level. But coming back to the state reaching into a community and saying you can't pass a lawful ordinance, I think is wrong. If the people of Charlotte got that ordinance passed and then in 2 years they have an election and they say we don't like that ordinance, I think on some level that's how they resolve those issues.
And so, interestingly, in the Charlotte case, you know, this was not an issue that they just brought up out of the blue. This had been something that they'd been debating for several years. In fact, several of the members of the council had been elected specifically on that issue, I believe. I could be wrong about that, but that they had been debating this when the city council was more conservative. An election took place, it became more liberal, and they went ahead and passed this. But it was done with a lot of community input, unlike at the state level where they went and passed it in 12 hours. You know, so we have this issue at the state legislature where sometimes they're passing bills very quickly with little public input. What do you think about that? And so if you were a legislator, how would you handle, you know, sort of fielding feedback from constituents, things like that?
Well, first of all, there's never a time when a representative of the people, whether he's in the Senate or he or she is in the Senate or he or she's in the House of Representatives here in North Carolina, or for that matter in Washington, when they shouldn't be listening to the words of their constituents. I'm a Democrat. I get elected to office, and I'm the next senator from this district. Wouldn't that be – I mean, that would put a smile on my face and hopefully others people's as well. But I wouldn't be a senator for the Democrats. When you get elected, it's your job to listen to all the constituents. And that means the ones in the Tea Party, and that means the ones on the progressive left. You need to listen to everybody because you are responsible to be their voice in Raleigh, everybody's voice in Raleigh. I don't know if that answers your question, but I think you can get a sense of what I feel the role of a representative is.
Yeah.
It's not to represent my own interests. My job is to represent the interests of people who live in the 48th District, to be an open ear for them. I don't think you go to the legislature and spend 30 minutes, put together a bill and throw it on the floor and say it's getting passed and too bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's not thoughtful. It doesn't take into account the voters of the community and what they may think or may feel. And on top of that, to add insult to injury, I mean, this HB2, it reaches into everybody's life in a much more insidious way. I mean, Asheville can't establish a living wage, you know, here in this community because HB2 forbids it.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong. That is not the way we should be doing business in North Carolina. We should be listening to what the people need.
I want to circle back around to your answer for HB2 because you came at it from this different perspective as a school principal, like you were saying. Are there any incidents that have occurred over your years that have sort of informed you on this issue? Have you seen kids in a vulnerable state, that sort of thing? And then also further on that, you know, the legislature passed this and the governor passed this claiming that they were doing it to protect young girls from predators, things like that. And how would you respond to that as well?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I think that's a big fat lie. There was absolutely no evidence that there were all these predators hanging around girls' rooms trying to abuse them. And it didn't exist. It was asked of people all across the state. Police officers, you know, law enforcement officials from Manteo to Bryson City to all over the state were saying it was a solution in search of a problem. There was no problem. This was all about control, I believe, and it was all about, I think it was all about the folks in Raleigh, the General Assembly, saying it's going to be our way, and this is where we stand ideologically, and you're going to have to follow our ideology in this state, whether you like it or not. And when I hear people talk, when I hear the governor, and I know that my opponent supports HB2, so when I think of him saying these same things, I want to say, wait a minute, what about human beings? We are people. You know, we shouldn't be judging people who are not criminals because their lifestyle is different or because they have a biological difference between themselves and other people because they can't, their identity was somehow genetically mismatched with their bodies when they were growing up. And there needs to be a way to say, we care about all of our citizens. And where there's no harm done, then nobody's freedom has been violated. if we were really having a huge problem with predators, there are already laws on the books to deal with people who are predators. We didn't need a new law that made people feel disenfranchised. Citizens of our state disenfranchised. Do you remember the Archie Bunker show, All in the Family?
No, not very well.
Well, if for those of you in the listening audience who may remember that, there was a wonderful scene. Archie Bunker, of course, was the amazing bigot of television who said the craziest things, and his wife Edith was a little bit silly and goofy sometimes. And his son-in-law, Michael, came home with a friend of his who happened to be gay. And I will never forget that. Archie was incensed, disgusted, offended. He couldn't say enough ugly things about him. And when Edith asked him, when Michael's friend was gone, Edith asked him, "Well, Archie, why are you so upset? What's the problem?" And Archie says, "Well, it's a sin against God." And she said, "Well, why not let God worry about it?" We don't need to make those decisions, and we don't need to treat people like they're less or subhuman in some way, like they're not entitled to human rights. It's our job as a legislature to protect rights, not to deny them to people.
And so you're a principal of an elementary school.
Yes.
So you're dealing with kids who are very young. I would guess, you know, in elementary school, you're sort of pre-sexuality. I mean, sexuality mm-hmm. is starting to come about, but I think a lot of people are struggling to understand the issue of what transgender people are. And there are so many different shades of what that can
yes.
mean. But have you had students come through that do identify with a different sex, and do they struggle more? I mean, what has been your experience?
Well, like I said, I've worked in schools all the way from kindergarten on up.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience as an elementary principal, I really haven't seen any issues come up. Usually the kids are older when those issues come up. But what we do get is kids who are in fourth grade and fifth grade who are 9 years old and 10 years old who are beginning to sense, well, boys and girls are different, and, you know, and we look a little bit different. And we, you know, in it's kids in school usually model behavior that they're taught, unfortunately, or fortunately in most cases, but sometimes unfortunately. And when we have a little boy in school get mad at another little boy, and instead of saying, "Oh, you know, I'm mad at you," they call him a name. You know, they'll use the F word, or they'll use some other kind of disparaging term to describe that child. And there's not a year I don't go by where I don't see children struggle with that, and children who feel beaten and mocked. And we have to protect those children. It doesn't start when they're 40 years old. It's too late to protect them in a sense when they're 40. We need to start now when they're little tiny people. And we need to help them grow into the people who are going to be our doctors and our lawyers and our politicians and our farmers and our car mechanics someday. And that they should be able to feel comfortable with who they are, the way they are. And they struggle with that, and we begin to see those struggles. And just as a sidebar, I've been at this for 44 years, and I can tell you that the kids are much more precocious now than they were when I started teaching over 40 years ago. Some of the things they talk about, some of the things they watch on TV, and have them thinking of themselves much older than they did 40 years ago. You know, I don't know that I understand the genesis of it altogether. You know, we school folks who've been around a long time, we have opinions. But we don't want children isolated. I think to bring that just around the corner, I don't want children isolated who are not sure of themselves at such a vulnerable time in their lives. And we shouldn't be passing laws that make it harder for them to grow up. We should be passing laws that make it easier for them to feel comfortable in their own skin.
And is it your opinion that laws like HB2 isolate children more?
I believe so. I don't believe that was the intent of the law. I don't think they were thinking, to be honest. I'm not sure they know what their intent was. Mm-hmm. I really would like to assume that their intent was an honorable one. I want to assume that. I really want to assume that, but it just doesn't feel that way, and it doesn't look that way.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it must be that the perception from outside the state of North Carolina is the one that you feel as well. Whether or not it was passed with a certain way, it doesn't feel a certain way. And that's why I think we're starting to see so many cancellations.
And we didn't even talk about the economic impact that that decision has had. It's been humongous. I heard the Grove Park Inn lost over $1 million contract after HB2 has passed. I have a friend who owns a business who is going to take his business out of the state because he's losing business because of HB2. And I can't understand how people can be so blind. I will tell you this. I wish they wouldn't leave. I wish they would stay and say, we're going to continue to work because people are losing their jobs. Jobs are critical. We need people to have good paying jobs in the state. And the decisions these businesses and the NBA and the NCAA are making are hurting people's pocketbooks, literally.
Yeah. So you disagree with the decisions to boycott?
No, I don't think I said that. I just said I wish they didn't because I'm concerned about the loss of employment that a lot of people are experiencing. I get it. As a matter of fact, Coach Krzyzewski, Duke, he said, well, what did they expect? I think that's as close to a direct quote as I can get.
Yeah, Coach K, too, it was sort of a notable person to comment on that because, you know, he's not necessarily the most liberal person.
No.
He's been, you know, I know that was known for donating to Elizabeth Dole's campaign. Otherwise, his politics is, you know, really unknown. He keeps it close to his chest. But he did answer on House Bill 2 as their Duke basketball schedule was affected by that. And now, of course, the ACC and NCAA tournament, of course. So
I'm anxious to see if the SoCon here in town is affected too.
Yeah, the Citizen Times ran a story speculating about that based on some comments from their commissioner, I think. Yeah. Well, let's talk some about education since that's so near and dear to your heart. What grade do you give if you're passing out a report card to the legislature for their jobs on public education over the past few years?
Can you give something lower than an F? I don't know. Today I was dealing with an issue. It's called RTA, Read to Achieve. Talk about screwy things. I mean, now this is not so much about a money issue, but tell me if this makes sense to you. Children enter the third grade. When they enter the third grade, they take a beginning of the year test. If they pass it, fine. If they don't, they get to work on portfolios or they get remedial assistance or something to help get them to where they should be at the start of the year. And then we evaluate the kids over and over and over again over the course of the year, you know, on reading in particular. It's not math. It's just reading we're talking about. And at the end of the year, they take an EOG, an end of grade test. If they fail the end of grade test, then they get to take it again. If they fail it the second time, then they get to go to a summer reading camp. At the summer reading camp, if their portfolios weren't finished from the school year, they work on them there. And then at the end of summer reading camp, they get to take another test. And if they fail that, then they don't get promoted to fourth grade. But wait a second. It's not done because they still go to a fourth grade classroom. But they're required, the school is required to teach them third grade curriculum in a fourth grade class with the other fourth graders around them. And then in October, they get to take the test again. And if they don't pass the test, then they have to pass these portfolios, these assessments that they have to do over the course of the year. And if they don't succeed then, we promote them to fifth grade.
That is a very confusing process that you just laid out for me. My head is spinning. So you've probably had to explain this multiple times to many different people.
I've had to explain it to myself because I don't get it. Now, I will tell you this much. If somebody said to me, we want every third grader to read on grade level at the end of third grade, I would say, that is a great idea. Boy, do we want that. But you know, children aren't like perfect little square blocks fitting into perfect little square holes. Some learn faster than others do. Some learn slower than others. Some struggle with enough nutrition at home and having a roof over their head. Some of them have family issues that make school harder. Some of them are just not real socially comfortable around other kids in school. I mean, every kid's different, and kids learn at their own pace, and it's our job to find the ones who are not keeping up and to help them. But tell me something. If you failed the same test over and over and over again, what would that do to your little 9-year-old ego?
Yeah, it would damage it, I would think.
I think so. And I think it's a cruel thing to do to those children. That's me.
Now, who's responsible for that? Is that, forgive my ignorance on it, is that a state policy?
Oh, yes. That is state law. The Read to Achieve Act is a state law. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that scares me when the state legislature gets involved in education. I mean, in the state legislature, 55-56% of our state budget is education. And yet only about 1% of our representatives there are educators. Now, I don't think they all have to be educators over there. I think we should have lawyers and we should have educators. We should probably have doctors and we should have business people. You know, we should have all kinds of backgrounds in the state legislature. But for so many people to have so much control over education who understand what makes schools work and what doesn't is pretty frightening. Now, that's just one example. We can talk about vouchers and how terrible they are, what a bad decision that was, which just yanks more money out of the public school system. We can talk about charter schools and what's gone wrong there. There are issues with charter schools. I will tell you that I am, as a candidate and as a human being, I am all about school choice. I think that's fine. What I'm not about is an uneven playing field. And our charter schools have different regulations and different rules that apply to them, different relationships with private entities who are coming in into the schools to have an influence over them. The original function of a charter school was to be a laboratory school in a community, and it's not anymore. In fact, Educational Leadership published an article about 2 years ago that showed very, very clearly that our public schools are far more innovative than our charter schools in general. Now, there are exceptions to that, of course. But if parents choose to have their children in a charter school, I'm fine with that. I don't have a problem with that. I don't object to it. I like that parents can choose. I like they can make choices for their kids. I just think that we need to be more mindful of being sure that what we expect of a child in a public school and what we expect of the staff in a public school is exactly the same in a charter school.
So what did you think of what the legislature did regarding charter schools? I believe what they had was a 100 charter school cap at first, and the Republican legislature recently lifted that cap. And yeah. I think it's nearly doubled the amount of charter schools that we have in the state.
Yeah, nearly.
What do you think? How would you have handled that differently?
Well, I wouldn't have lifted the cap. Mm-hmm. I think that was a mistake. And I think as a legislator, I think we should say, well, we came up with this vision of schools that could be laboratories for school change and school growth. And it should be our expectation that that's exactly what they are. If they're not doing innovative programs, then I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the way they've grown. I think right now it's more about choice and less about improving the profession. Mm-hmm. And growing the profession. And like I said, I don't mean to reiterate myself, but it's a mistake that people make to think that those charter schools are more innovative than our public schools. There is no evidence of that. Right here in Buncombe County, we've got this wonderful STEM high school now. Talk about innovation. We've got the early college and the middle college going on over the AB Tech campus. We are finding ways to reach kids that we have never found before. Even in my school, we're reaching STEM into the elementary schools now and STEM labs and opportunities for kids to grow in the most progressive area of education we've got. And I'd have to say that I would challenge our charters to show that they're doing anything different. Mm-hmm. Some of them are doing the same things, mm-hmm. but they're different.
You also mentioned the voucher program, and you mentioned opposition to that, saying it was a bad idea, sucking money from the public schools. Could you be a little more specific about that? What is your opposition to the voucher program?
Well, first of all, vouchers go to people who, at least in theory, are poor people, people who don't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so they give them a voucher for $4,200, which, number one, is considerably less than the amount of money we have per pupil in the state, which is well above that. And they tell those people they can go to schools that don't have to have licensed personnel working in them. They don't have any accountability for testing or evaluating their students. They don't have any responsibility to have licensed administration or to have a curriculum that the state approves. And they don't have to test their kids and evaluate what they're learning. So I guess I just reiterated my accountability comment. Mm-hmm. So basically, we are taking our public tax dollars and we're investing it into schools that have no real responsibility to account for what they do here in North Carolina. I don't think that's fair to kids. Now, that's not a slam on private schools. There are some great private schools out there, but they don't cost $4,200 a year. I mean, they're considerably more expensive. So our families are having to make tough economic choices. And I find it ironic that the state, which demands so much accountability in our public schools, so much that it's overly burdensome, is so willing to just give up on a whole population of children and say to them, we don't care what you learn. It's nothing to us. Just take your money and go. I think it's wrong. I think it's an immoral decision. And I hope that someday it'll get kicked into the courts again and ruled on again. So far, the courts have supported North Carolina's decision to do that. But if I got into the Senate, I would want us to work hard to undo that law. To get rid of it altogether.
Well, it does kind of fly in the face that you talked about. You're in favor of school choice. So is your opposition to that just basically that it's pulling money from the public school system and sending it ostensibly to these private schools or private groups or whatever they may be?
No. To me, it's not a choice decision to tell people to give their child an inferior education.
I see.
It doesn't serve the public interest. Charter schools at least have to use the state curriculum to teach their kids, and they do have to give their kids the EOGs at the end of the year. They don't have to have all licensed staff. I think the law requires that 50% of the staff has to be licensed, which I don't think is so good, but that's beside the point. At least there are some standards that the state holds them to before they give them their money, and that's not true. It's like we're condemning children to a less than adequate education and hoping that it prepares them for what? I mean, who knows if they'll be able to read at the end of school? Who knows if they'll know anything about our country's history or about any basic science? Who knows, will they be able to write paragraphs? Will they be able to communicate with people adequately? There's just so many questions. That said, I'm going to say this again. There are some private schools that do a really great job with kids. I know of some. I used to work in a private school. I started my career as a private teacher, a private school teacher. Now, we had a lot of demands on us. That was in the state of Virginia at the time. But I'm very concerned about what we do with education, and I'm very concerned with how we use our money. And taking good money that should be supporting all the schools in the state and putting it into schools, into the hands of people to put into schools that really don't meet the needs or can't guarantee that they're out there trying to meet the needs of the – and don't have to tell us, by the way.
And just like HB2, this does kind of get into LGBT rights again, because some of these institutions or a majority, I think, have been religious institutions that have may have policies to deny lesbians or gay people into their schools and that sort of thing.
Some of them have even written it right into their school's bylaws that you can't be this or you can't be that to come to their school.
Yeah.
So on top of, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that's something else that bugs me about the voucher thing, is we're giving voucher money to people to sometimes go to schools that are designed to segregate one group from another group. And I think segregation is a pretty bad message.
What do you think of the job of the legislature on teacher pay?
Not satisfactory at all. This, you know, the governor is at $50,000 a year, you know, is the average pay for teachers. All you have to do is walk through my building. And we don't have a lot. I'm at a small school. If you ask those teachers, I don't think you'll find one making that kind of money. I'm glad that they increased pay for beginning teachers. That was a good thing to do. It might help us a little bit get people to leave the state at a slower rate to get better jobs elsewhere. But the end game is important to people, too. So once you've gotten past step 20 on the pay scale, which is about $50,000, well, you're not going anywhere else to speak of. And so our people really going to want to become career educators? Some of the most valuable teachers we have are career educators with 20 or more years. What's the enticement for them to stay in their jobs? And that concerns me, and it concerns me greatly. That's number one. Governor McCrory is sadly misled. I know my opponent will tell you we'd get a great job in the Senate giving teachers raises. Well, they left a whole population of people out. They also took away longevity pay, which encourages people to keep a career in education. They say they rolled that into the raises they gave teachers. They've taken away longevity pay, period, end of sentence. They took that away. They took away the ability of teachers to go out and earn advanced degrees and earn additional pay with those advanced degrees. The only exception would be is if the job in particular requires an advanced degree. Like to be a school administrator, I had to have a master's in school administration. To be a school counselor, you have to have a master's. Those people do get paid. And they have grandfathered in people who already had one. I don't think legally they could have done away with it under any other circumstance. They had to do that. Mm-hmm. But they did take away due process rights for teachers by taking away career status for them. They've made the pay issue and the career status issue, they've made teaching a very unattractive career. Right now, North Carolina is having trouble finding school administrators. We are the lowest paid school administrators in the United States. I sometimes think maybe the Fiji Islands make less than we do. I don't know. But we are the lowest paid in the United States. And how does that entice people to seek out management as a career? And we need good school leaders. In fact, most research will tell you that the success of a school is tied directly to the quality of school leadership and what that school leader expects of the staff and the standards that they hold. So school leadership is a big deal. That's just one example. Why ignore that? And back to the end game again. Boy, I just bounced around. But back to the end game. Teachers in other states finish their careers making $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 more than our teachers here in North Carolina. If I'm a single person and I just graduate from UNCA and I don't have anything to hold me here, why would I want to work here when I could drive across the border into Virginia and make thousands and thousands of dollars more than I am here?
Have you lost teachers at your school over pay issues?
Not my school, no. Mm-hmm. No, but I know of my colleagues who have.
But you're in the hallways and you hear people talk. What is the mood like?
The morale is very low.
Morale is low.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the only bright spot in terms of morale is that I'm blessed to work with really good teachers who absolutely love children. Mm-hmm. And they would do anything for them. I was talking to one of my teachers today. My music teacher, and she was telling me that last year when money was even tighter than it is now, she was saying that she had to reach into her pocket to pay for things. Well, she sees, 600, 700 kids a day as a music teacher, a week. And she's trying to buy things that they need, the second-year teacher on the lowest end of the pay scale, trying to get the things that she needs for her students. And that I told her to never do that again. I said, if you need something, you come see me. I will find a way, by gosh and by golly, to take care of you. But it's not easy. We need the help of lots of agencies. You know, schools do big fundraisers now because we don't have enough money coming in the school to take care of basic
things. Yeah, I mean, teachers don't get into the profession for the money. they get into it for the kids.
Yes.
So probably a lot of them are sticking it out.
Yes, and hoping for better days.
Yeah.
A lot of them are, and I'm really glad you pointed that out. It's an incredibly empowering thing to be a school principal and to walk through the halls and to listen in the classrooms and see how magnificent. It's almost like a sort of a state of grace when a teacher reaches into a child and a child reaches into their teacher in that perfect moment, that almost symbiotic moment where they're talking to each other sometimes without words, and it makes all the difference in the world in a child's life. You can't pay people enough to do that, and you can't pay them little enough to keep them away from it. Teachers love kids. They wouldn't be there if they didn't.
Right.
And they love the fact that they know that what they're doing will hopefully make this state a better state and our country a better country. We have a lot of real patriots working in the building. And people who have great hopes for the future of their children. I always like to tell the story, you know, and next time, I don't know if you like going to kindergarten classes.
I haven't gone to one since I was in kindergarten.
You might think of it sometime just to walk through and say, oh, look, that little five-year-old with his finger in his nose, isn't he cute? And then say, right. And someday he may be taking my appendix out. What kind of an education do I want that child to have?
Yeah.
you know you want him to have the best education he possibly can get.
Right.
And we owe it to our children to do that and to the future of our state and our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's shift from education and talk about the taxes. You mentioned the taxes. a lot of changes to tax policy, lowered taxes, but expanded sales taxes. What do you think of the job of the legislature on taxes? What would you like to see happen?
Well, obviously, I'm not happy with it. You know, if I hear the governor one more time say that we've lowered your personal taxes, I would say, well, yeah, some people you did. You know, some people are paying less in personal taxes than they used to. Some people are paying much less, especially millionaires. They are paying a much lower percentage of taxes than they used to. But if you talk to people in the business community, especially small businesses, I was talking to a fellow who owns a brewery in Brevard the other day. He's furious. He's paying all kinds of fees he never had to pay before and new things to him. He didn't elaborate on all of them, and I'm not a small businessman, so I don't know them all. But he was talking about fees for this and people who are doing inspections who come in the building, pass him a piece of paper, he signs it, and they leave. And they say they've inspected this or that or the other thing. And he has to pay for all of that, and he has to pay for those privileges. So we're seeing more fees. We're seeing our poor having to bear a heavier burden of taxes. They all have to pay taxes on services now. I always say that a government is going to get their, in this case, in North Carolina's case, they want their $22 billion, and they're going to get it by gosh or by golly. They're going to find a way to get that money. The problem is who they get the money from. Do we excuse our largest corporations and say, well, they create jobs? Isn't that great? Yeah, that's really great. But they also use our roads. They need the fire department. They need the police to work with them. Mm-hmm. And they need all the public services that everybody else needs to take care of those corporations. So while their taxes go down, poor people and people in the middle class, they've been watching their fees and their taxes go up. And, you know, if you talk to people, they'll tell you that their tax burden is almost identical to what it ever was, maybe even worse now than it was before. Why? Because we haven't changed the amount of money we want in the government. We've just changed how we're getting it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's falling on the backs of the wrong people, the people who can least afford it.
Staying on the economy, also Medicaid is a big issue. Many states have expanded Medicaid. Many states have not. North Carolina is one that has not. This is something that the Democratic Party has been pushing for and pushing for, and it's not likely to happen anytime soon unless the Republican Party comes on board. What would you like to see as far as Medicaid goes? Because there were some changes made in the last session, efforts to send it more to a private model.
Oops. There's something that'll work well. Look at the private models leaving the state, you know, and mm-hmm. insurance companies and the like. From my point of view, our state has made an incredible error in judgment. Well, first of all, we're talking about 380,000 people who have no insurance in this state right now and can't get it because they make less than $10,400 a year. I believe that was the magic cutoff. And so here they are. They're making this piddling little pay. And the only place for them to get medical care is by going to emergency rooms. So they go to the emergency rooms. They can't pay for their care in the emergency rooms. And all the rest of us get that piled into our insurance rates. So our insurance rates go up for everybody who can pay for insurance, which makes everybody mad. They don't want to do that. They say, well, Obamacare is really messing up. Well, we're really messing up. North Carolina is passing up $2 billion per year of money returned to us from taxes we already pay. $2 billion. So if you don't care about people, and you don't care about their health, and you don't care about whether they've got enough food on the table, aren't you impressed by $2 billion a year? Don't all those zeros make your mouth wet up with joy? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. $2 billion, 23,000 good-paying jobs would come back to our state. Better service to our people in rural communities. That would come into play. All those things get better, and the health of our citizens, our children, our adults, their parents and their grandparents, everything gets better when we expand Medicaid. And I can't, for the life of me, think how Republicans can't see the simple logic of it. For my money, if I had a magic wand, we'd have a single-payer system, but we don't. We've got Obamacare, and it's got its bumps that need to be addressed. And anybody who says it's perfect is wrong. But anybody who says it's dastardly is wrong, too. If you go into other states where they've expanded Medicaid and where they have an active marketplace for insurance, insurance rates have come down. But not in North Carolina. We want to make people pay for the privilege of being sick in this state. And we want them to pay big time by denying poor people the care they so desperately need every day. Mm-hmm. It's wrong. It's not a moral decision in my view.
You know, at one point in the presidential race, Hillary Clinton had a big lead in the polls, and people were starting to talk about a landslide election. But even while they were talking about a landslide election, no one was talking about our House or our Senate switching back to the Democrats, because the gerrymandered districts have made that pretty much impossible right now. So I think that even if this were a great election for Democrats, you'll still be heading in, even if you win, you'll still be heading in the minority party. How can you be an effective legislator as a member of the minority party, and how do you reach across the aisle to get things done?
Well, you know, that's a fair question to ask, because people are so polarized now. I'm not polarized. I spoke to a Republican who shall remain nameless here, who pointed out to me the strength of the leadership in the party. If you don't do A, you don't get B. Well, I'm 65 years old. I don't care if I get B or not. You know, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that we work together to solve problems and that we take care of the people of North Carolina. I would have no trouble, even if it irritated people, to reach across the aisles and to do what I said much earlier in this interview, which was, it's our job to represent all the people. Mm-hmm. I would listen to my constituents, and I would try my best to represent their interests. And where I hear those interests, that's when I would know what was good or bad. And if that required me to shake hands and to work hard to have a good relationship with the opposition party, then it should be a respectful opposition, and we should end up accomplishing things for our state and for our people. That's really a bottom line with me. I like people, and I spend every day. I mean, there's not a day I don't have to deal with people who don't agree with me about something. Mm-hmm. I'm a school principal. You know, they may not like the schedule I put in place, so they may not like this or that.
Yeah.
But I know how to work with people. Mm-hmm. I get along mostly with people all the time. I'm not a name caller, which is a total waste of time and stupid, and I mean beyond belief. It's important for me to know that that Republican over there was elected in his district to serve his people, and I need to respect that. When I lived in a military community overseas, I remember a bunch of soldiers were pretty angry at a four-star general who was on our base. And when he walked by, they saluted. And I said, gosh, I thought you guys didn't like him. He said, well, in the military, we learned something. We learned that you respect the uniform, whether you like who's wearing it or not. Mm-hmm. And the object is to understand where that person came from, how they got to where they are, and to understand what their job is. It's our job to respect one another. I'd say that to kids in school. I would say that to any adult I meet. Respect is everything. And the way we treat each other matters. We can reach across the aisle because we can respect one another and understand that because Chuck Edwards doesn't want to expand Medicaid, that's his opinion, and he feels like he's representing the interests of his district when he has that. That's why we have an election on November 8th. If people agree with him, then they'll vote for him. Mm-hmm. If they don't agree with him, they'll vote for me. And if they vote for me and I win this election, then it's my job to respect whoever gets elected anywhere and say, this was the will of the people, and we need to make sure the will of the people is respected.
I'm hoping to interview Chuck Edwards as well. Haven't heard from his campaign yet, but I'm making efforts. Have you had a chance to talk with him? And what's your understanding of him? What assessment do you have of your opponent?
Well, I think he's somebody who, if we weren't politicians, you know, and have differences of opinion about that, I think I'd probably get along just fine with him. And I think I'd get along fine with him even with differences of opinion, because like I said, I can respect that. It's okay. He's got his, I've got mine. We've come from wherever we come from in terms of developing our opinions. I disagree with him on almost everything, you know, political, except both of us like the rails to trails idea and the Acosta trail. So we have a little bit of agreement there, which is a nice thing. So what do I think? You know, I look at his Facebook page. He probably looks at mine. So he knows what my views are. I think I have an understanding. When I say he supports HB2, it's in there. I mean, he's, you know, committed himself to that. I just fundamentally disagree with his views about some of these things, and, mm-hmm. and that in particular. I believe that he's a hardworking man, and I believe he's been very successful building a, you know, McDonald's franchise mini empire, and congratulations for that. But now it's time to talk about what's going to make our community better and what's going to make life better for all people in West and North Carolina. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm talking about I'll be talking about establishing a wage that people can actually live on and understand historically. You know, people like Chuck will say, well, if you do that, it'll cause inflation. And history doesn't teach us that. Mm-hmm. History teaches us that when we raise people's pay, it doesn't create inflation. It creates more consumers, more taxpayers. Probably the Republicans would like to hear that. So give them more money. They will pay more in taxes and they will need fewer services from the state. It's a win-win for everybody.
How is the campaign going? Because you know, you mentioned that this is a very conservative district. Mm-hmm. You're coming here from work, so you're not taking time off from work.
No.
And so how do you run an effective campaign while you're still working? How do you raise the money? I mean, how's it going?
Well, I'd like to tell you I've raised all the money I need, but I don't have $500,000 in my account. Mm-hmm. But and you know something, I wouldn't want to have the $500,000 in my account. Fundraising has been difficult. I don't get out as much as a lot of other candidates do, especially to daytime activities. Mm-hmm. I have to play catch up a lot. Mm-hmm. I use Facebook a lot to communicate with people. We are working real hard to be as effective as we can. And I sort of decided, you know, the model up in Congress, if you listen to NPR and other stations, the model up in Congress is those guys are required to be on the phone raising money for several hours a day.
Right.
And that's part of their job. I've decided that for me, right now, this point in my life, that as much as I would like to be on the phone raising money, it's more valuable for me to meet as many people as I can. So I go to whatever I can, wherever I can, whenever I can to meet people.
I see.
To shake hands, to talk to people. When I'm done here, for example, I'm headed over to the state fair, to the Democratic booth there, where mm-hmm. Hopefully run into some Henderson County and some Buncombe County and some Transylvania County Democrats and hand them the card, like the one I passed you earlier today, mm-hmm. that tells them about my candidacy and some of my beliefs. I guess what I'm saying is it's been tough. I'm not 25 anymore. I'm on the road almost every night, and it's very challenging. But I will tell you this much. On November 9th, win or lose, I'm going to fall into my bed that night. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a deep sleep, win or lose. And the next morning, I'm going to get in my car. I'm going to drive to school, and I'm going to teach my children. You know, win or lose, nothing about that is going to change. And nothing's going to change about me, because win or lose, I haven't tied my ego to winning an election. I've tied my sense of purpose to winning it because I believe I have a better idea for what Western North Carolina and the state can be than mm-hmm. my opponent does.
Well, and you know, you're in this tough district, and so many others are. Many people are running unopposed in this election.
Yeah.
And so the issue of voting rights and gerrymandering comes in. And there have been a number of court decisions in the past several weeks. Last week when I was interviewing people, I was opening up with questions about that because that was the big news of the day. What do you think of all these court decisions on things like voter ID, early voting, and the redrawing of these districts?
Well, I think it tells us two things, that the party in charge, the Republicans, have rushed and hastily passed bills without vetting them properly to determine their constitutionality. I think that's one thing. And I don't think that they've shared ideas much. I know one of my friends who's a legislator and a Democrat tells me that it's almost atypical for them to be consulted, even on the most basic things. I think they were handed the state budget a half an hour before it was to be on the floor for a vote. How do you look at a huge thing like a $22 billion budget in half an hour and make any suggestions or ideas?
Yeah.
That's the not working across the aisle thing. Chances are, had they shared it with the Democrats, there could have been some good debate and discussion about it, and they might have come up with some better ideas, better ways to manage the state's money. So that's one thing. But I think the lack of constitutionality of some of our laws is very telling. It's a rush to make to a decision that that wasn't properly vetted, wasn't properly cared for, and there was a lack of debate, too few hearings or no hearings at all in making these decisions. And it has everything to do with the Republican agenda of wanting to be in control. In the way of a mea culpa, the Democrats, before the Republicans were in charge, weren't so magnanimous either. Mm-hmm. We need to change that. When I go to the state Senate, should I win, I am not going to be the Democrat who says, well, now I've won, I'm going to get even for what you've done. That's a bunch of garbage. It's certainly not the American way, and it's not good for North Carolina. We need to work together.
You know, there's been some maps released by the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy and Common Cause North Carolina, I think, that kind of gave an example of what a nonpartisan map might look like. Would you be in favor of pushing for nonpartisan redistricting, an independent commission, that sort of thing?
Yes, and you know who else was?
Who's that?
Tom Apodaca.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to do that, too, until he became the majority party. Which goes right back to my point, you know.
Yeah.
Redistricting is what the winners do to the losers.
Right.
And it's not nice. It's not ethical. It's not moral. It doesn't serve the voters' interests.
Yeah.
It needs to be changed. Yes, I'm all for a nonpartisan commission.
Where do you stand on voter ID?
Well, I will tell you that I think it was a mistake to do what they did. It was clear what the Republicans did. They made access to the polls more difficult for people, totally unnecessary. Again, it was a law in search of a problem. There was no problem in North Carolina with voter ID fraud or anything else like it. Mm-hmm. And I think to say so is disingenuous at best. So from my point of view, those laws should never have existed. And now, to discover in the courts and listening to testimony, to discover that it was clearly the intent to disenfranchise African Americans, what is that all about? I mean, are we going back to Jim Crow or what? We can't do that again. We have grown. We're better people, smarter than we used to be. And we don't want to backstep anymore. We want to enfranchise people, not disenfranchise them. Mm-hmm. So I was opposed to the changes in the law. Now, had we had examples of voter fraud in our state, maybe I'd feel differently. But we couldn't find them even after the fact when the party in control was doing hearings across the state or checking this out across the state. They couldn't find voter fraud. I think they did find one Republican who was registered in two in a district in Florida and a district up here, who was a legislator, as a matter of fact. I mean, I think they found that, but I don't think they found much more than that. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe we've had voter fraud in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I'm not ignorant. I know that there have been stories in Chicago and other places where they've had that problem sometimes in their past history, especially back in the days of Al Capone and those guys. You know, I understand that there have been problems with it, but they're not our problems, and they're not our problems today. We need to make it easier for people to vote, not harder.
Mm-hmm. One last legislative issue, the environment. I just want to get your sense of how the legislature has performed on environmental issues. You know, there's been the Duke-Asheville conversion plan, which has less to do with the legislature, but they did have quite a role in streamlining the process for Duke Energy to convert to natural gas. Where do you stand on that plant? And then I'll ask some follow-up questions about renewable energy.
Well, on the plant, again, I think we need to hear the opinion of the people about that. There are some small groups of people I've heard who've been very upset that they're what's the right word for that? Refitting the plant or
replacing it, maybe.
Replacing
I'm
it
not
with,
really
with
sure.
one to run on natural gas, if my memory is correct on that.
Yeah.
And I think we need to ask the people. Again, there should be hearings, just like there were for those power lines that were going to cut through some of our beautiful farm country. I think we need to say to the people, how do you feel? Let's have hearings. Let our legislators hear the opinions of the people. Mm-hmm. Duke is an amazing company. I mean, there's some real positives to Duke. Look at the power they provide us. So we shouldn't discount their opinions about what works and what doesn't. But it should be their opinion, and it's not the way they shouldn't dictate policy. And our legislature, in the absence of input from people, from their citizens, shouldn't discount the opinion of their citizens, their constituents. You mentioned coal ash before. They've streamlined that too.
Oh,
you know, they even apparently have covered up the fact that the groundwater has been poisoned by coal ash. They've extended the time that Duke has to handle the problem. They've basically given Duke permission to not line these coal ash ponds that need to be lined right now. And we have people who trust our government agencies to keep them healthy and to keep their water clean. And they haven't achieved that right now. You know, even if I was unaffiliated, I think I would look at that and say, holy cow, what is our governor thinking? We don't want a Flint, Michigan here. We don't want a Love Canal in North Carolina. we're looking at that possibility. It destroys property values. It makes people sick, gives them cancer. I mean, it's all very serious. The other part of it is that they have a sort of a limited liability in terms of responsibility to the individuals who have been affected by these coal ash ponds and by leaching coal ash and the poisons from coal ash into groundwater, people who own wells. I think they have an obligation to make it right, and I think it's the courts who should determine what should happen with that. Duke Energy makes profits of anywhere in a good year, $2 billion a year. A bad year, maybe $1.5 billion. They're making lots and lots of money and serving their stockholders well. I think they also have an obligation to serve all of their clients well, not just the people who invest in Duke, but also the people who benefit, who should be benefiting from the heat and the cooling that we get from Duke and the water that's pulled out of our wells. And we have an obligation to see to it that Duke is a responsible neighbor. Mm-hmm. And I think 9 times out of 10 they're going to be. But this coal ash thing is completely irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on renewable energy? You know, there's been efforts to roll back the renewable energy portfolio standard. Also, the solar tax credit expired. And there was an effort in the most recent session to block large swaths of the state off to wind energy. That effort failed, but it could be revived in the coming session. So where do you stand on solar and wind?
Well, first of all, solar and wind are not just pie-in-the-sky alternative energy sources anymore. They are making a difference in this state. They're still not cheap in terms of technology. That's where the tax credits need to come in that have been disappeared, if you will, by our legislature. I think we need to restore those tax credits and encourage the rapid development of solar gathering potential as well as wind potential. I think it's a mistake for the state to do otherwise. I know my opponent believes in offshore drilling. He said we should be drilling offshore. He discounts the potential of having a Gulf of Mexico situation there. With all those hurricanes that come across our coast, I don't think it's safe to be doing that. Again, we're worrying too much about making corporations and corporate interests rich, and we're not watching the real bottom line, which is about this tall. And this tall, you can't see that on the radio, can you?
Yeah.
But it, you know,
I'd say you're looking about 4 feet and 5 feet.
5 feet. There you go. And so my opinion is that the real bottom line is people and their health. Ultimately, we need to get away from using fossil fuels. Climate change is real. It's real science. And denying the reality of the science is a terrible mistake. Anybody who doesn't know that the oceans are rising, getting deeper, is not paying attention to the frequent flooding we have during bad storms on our coastal cities. In South Carolina as well, North Carolina, it's flooding right now in Florida from a tropical storm. Those things are happening quicker and more frequently than in the past. Even if we don't have a hurricane come across our land and reach into the heart of North Carolina, we're still getting flooding in our lower-lying areas, in Nag's Head and those places. That's serious. And it's also a symptom of the fact that we're getting a lot of glacial melt in the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's even changed the carbon parts per million in our atmosphere. It's dramatically higher now than it was in the 1970s. That has an effect on all life in the ocean and our lives as well. Where we can't protect the lives of the animals in our community, whether they're here in the forest or out in the ocean, if we can't protect those lives, we make ourselves vulnerable. So I'm opposed to fracking, and I'm opposed to offshore drilling. And I don't really believe that fracking is going to happen here. Geologists, if you study any geologist, they would tell you that there's not much to frack, if they have anything, here in the mountains. I'm more worried about people coming and taking our water and using it to frack elsewhere. That troubles me.
I've been asking candidates who come in about their views on the presidential race because it is so polarizing. And I think that for voters, it may be a sort of a barometer for how a candidate may think. So what do you think about Hillary Clinton and what do you think about Donald Trump?
Oh, boy. I hope to avoid federal politics. Golly Moses. I'm scared. Hillary Clinton doesn't scare me. Okay. I worry about some of the things that people report, but I also know that when you look at PolitiFacts, then you look at her integrity as compared to Donald's, that she is far better off in that area than Donald Trump is. He does a better job, I think, of making a point of her foibles. I'd like to see her. you know something, I really wouldn't like to see her do a better job of pointing out his weaknesses. I would rather they focus on the issues instead of talking about character and personalities. But if you remember that movie, An American President, wonderful movie with Michael Douglas, at the end of the movie he said, well, I've been president for these many years, and he said, I can tell you that it's all about character. Well, I don't trust Donald Trump's character in the White House. I don't trust him with his finger on the button. And I do trust Hillary Clinton. She has shown herself historically to be good at working across the aisle and working well with people of differing opinions. She's shown herself to be very good about bringing people to her team who are good people, smart people. I spoke to a fellow who lived in New York State, and she did an incredible job helping agriculture in Western New York hook up with the restaurant business in New York City. Total opposites of the state. And by the way, very liberal New York City, very conservative Western New York. And she was able to get those people to sit down together and come up with agreements that benefited everybody. Two diverse bodies sitting down in a room with a senator who made all the difference together. And I believe that she is going to do a great job as president. And I am hoping and praying that that's what happens.
Well, in the interest of saving time, I won't ask you about all the statewide races.
Thank God.
As a Democrat, I'm sure I know where you stand on
most of those races.
Before we go, what message would you send out to would-be voters, your supporters, anything like that ahead of the election?
I think it's time for people to put an educator in the legislature, and that would be me. I think I have a lot to offer the state. I've got a great work ethic. I think that's evident from the way I'm running my campaign. I do not neglect my job along the way, nor the children at my school. I remember that they're my first priority all the time. So if they want somebody who's going to work hard, who's going to listen, I'm real good at listening to people and to listen to diverse opinions. I'm not offended when people disagree with me. I believe that all that is an opportunity. When somebody disagrees, it's an opportunity to work together and come up with solutions together to real problems. If people would like me to be their senator, they'll be real pleased with the way I listen to them, the way I will bring City Hall-type discussions back when we're not in session so that people can have direct contact with me. Even the Tea Party would be amazed to see that I will reach out to them, and I will reach out to Republicans who don't agree with me about issues and say, come and talk to me. Let's see if we can find common ground to move forward with. And I'd like people to know, especially the Republicans out there, especially the Republicans, that I am a small government, property rights Democrat, which is, I think, a little bit different than our legislature is right now. They seem to be all about big government, and they seem to be all about deciding what people can and cannot do with their property. And I think people will be able to count on that when I'm in office. So please vote for me.
All right. Well, Norm Bossert, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
You're very welcome. And I've had a good time. Thank you.